Hello, and welcome to the Dietitian Cafe, brought to you by Nualtra, the innovative medical nutrition company dedicated to improving patients' lives through specialised and affordable supplements. My name is Corinne Toyne, and I'm a registered dietitian and marketing specialist at HRS Communications. So on today's episode, as women's health becomes less of a taboo topic, conversations surrounding menstruation, menopause, and conditions such as polycystic ovary syndrome, otherwise known as PCOS, are becoming more commonplace. Some individuals are homing in on their hormonal health and looking for nutritional solutions to positively impact their hormones. But is it all just another nutrition fad? Can you actually balance your hormones with your diet? Is that necessary? And what does the evidence say? Join us today as we examine a selection of the diets and ideas you may have heard about in this area, as well as discussing hormonal health in some specific women's health conditions. I'm delighted to welcome two expert guests today, both registered dietitians working in the women's health space, Jody Ralph and Laura Clark. Jody specializes in polycystic ovarian syndrome, which is often abbreviated to PCOS, and Laura specializes in menopause, making them well-placed to join us for today's episode. I'll hand over to them to introduce themselves a little further. Jody, let's start with you.
Thanks, Corinne. Like you mentioned, I'm a registered dietitian and my focus is primarily on providing specialised support for individuals with polycystic ovarian syndrome or PCOS. I also proudly serve as a media spokesperson for the British Dietetics Association, and my journey began when I was diagnosed with PCOS in my early 20s. I quickly realised the scarcity of reliable guidance on managing this condition. And I'm now determined to make a difference. I've dedicated myself to extensive research, translating scientific findings into practical advice tailored specifically for those with PCOS. Beyond being a dietitian, I also hold qualifications as a Pilates instructor, and I love that I can integrate movement into my holistic approach to wellness. I'm passionate about creating PCOS-friendly recipes that are both nutritious and delicious. And balancing my professional life, I'm also a mum of two very busy little human beings, and I'm a fair weather paddleboarder.
Great. And how about you, Laura?
Hi, lovely to be here. Thank you for having me. So yes, I'm Laura Clark. I'm a registered dietitian, as you said. I established the menopause dietitian a couple of years ago, really off the back of my freelance consultancy, because I realised that I was predominantly seeing women who had quite complex relationships with food, those that had been on the diet train for a couple of decades or more. And soon realised that actually once they were heading into their 40s and we had this extra dynamic of their hormonal shifts and perimenopausal years, that actually that was another dimension that was really knocking these women sideways. So it made sense to me to delve more into hormonal health, to understand its implications for women in navigating choices, because by midlife we're a bit messy, and for me it's all about bringing that psychological approach to my work, looking at things like behavioral therapy and acceptance and commitment therapy. I work under an intuitive eating framework. I do a lot of work around mindset, and I integrate that with solid evidence-based nutritional science, which is actually quite difficult to decipher. The menopausal market is rife with wellness influencers looking to make their mark. And I think I see my role as really trying to help women navigate those choppy waters and get clear and concise information to navigate their health at this time. So that's a little bit of my ethos and what I bring to the table. I too am midlife, juggling some tweenagers. So I like to keep it very real in terms of the advice that I give. I think it's important that we combine nutrition science with real world practicalities. So yeah, that's me.
Well, thank you both for those fantastic introductions. Let's get started the way we always do with a couple of quick fire questions. Jodie, let's go to you first. What does a perfect winter weekend day look like for you?
So for me, I think weekday mornings always just feel like this mad rush to get everyone ready and out the house. So I love a slow morning. Well, as slow as two little people will allow. So sitting in bed with a cup of tea and kind of just being able to wake up slowly, chatting about what everyone would like to do for the day. We love a family breakfast on the weekend. So we'll either do a big cooked breakfast or we'll do stacks of pancakes. And then just getting outside, getting everyone out into the fresh air, going for a walk, ideally with some friends, and ending off at a pub for a nice big traditional kind of Sunday roast. And then to be able to head home in the afternoon and just chill out. I'm quite a homebody, so I enjoy, just being at home with the family, doing puzzles, watching a movie, playing out in the garden again if the weather allows. Yeah, and also I like starting my Monday feeling really prepared. So I will do the geeky bit of kind of planning everything for the week, looking at everyone's schedule, and just kind of making sure that I start that Monday knowing that we're not in a complete state of chaos.
Sounds good. I love pancakes myself. So yeah, sounds like an ideal Saturday or Sunday to me. And how about you, Laura?
Yes, I feel I'm probably a bit of a carbon copy of Jodie, actually. I think it's about getting out. I'm very lucky to live in the countryside, so it's yeah, it's lovely to go out for a stomp and get the wellies muddy. And I think it's an opportunity to talk as a family, which quite often that doesn't happen quite so easily, perhaps when we're in the house. So yeah, a bit of exercise, good food. And some downtime, guilt-free downtime, quite like a cheeky bath on a Sunday afternoon. Yeah, a bit of self-care, I think, is really key so that we are, yeah, I feel like I'm in the right frame of mind for a Monday morning for sure.
Totally, absolutely love a bubble bath. Couldn't ask for better Sunday evening activity there. And how about you, Joni, in terms of the next question then? What are you enjoying reading or watching at the moment?
So I've actually just started reading a book called Minimalista by Shira Gill. I don't know if it comes from having two children and feeling like I'm in a constant state of chaos or surrounded by chaos and toys and stuff. But I think I'm also just going through a bit of a phase where I think I've realized we've made to believe that we need so much stuff and we need things all the time, and we really actually don't. So I'm really enjoying kind of reading her book and going through this process of understanding what we actually need and just simplifying life a little bit, decluttering.
Amazing. And what about you, Laura?
Well, I suppose reading for me feels like it's one of those things I'd like to do more of, but actually by the time I get into bed, I'm just so tired I want to go to sleep. So I think I'm probably more at the moment into a little bit of cheeky television downtime. I am a big fan of things like Dragon's Den because they help me to believe that maybe one day I too might make my millions. I quite like The Apprentice because it makes me realize that actually I am quite clever and there are other people out there who make silly mistakes like I feel like I do a lot. Loved the latest series of Traitors. I love human behavior generally, I find hugely fascinating. So I was absolutely hooked on that one.
Yeah, there's quite a few good episodes of TV series on at the moment. I'm also a fan of all of those things as well. I love a bit of Dragon's Den.
Yes.
It's
Yeah,
so interesting.
it's difficult to fit it all in, but I try my best.
Yeah. Great. So let's move on to the episode questions. You both have significant experience in the area of women's health and hormone-related conditions. So before we dive into the debate, what attracted you to this area? Laura, should we go to you first on this one?
Well, as I said in my intro, I think that hormones are something that don't stay static in a woman's life. Obviously, across the month, there are huge fluctuations. And as a woman goes into perimenopause, those fluctuations become even more significant. And so, when we're thinking about navigating the nutrition world for our clients, to not have an understanding of how hormones fits into that, I don't think enables us to, to be as grounded and as holistic as we need to be to really, really support women. So for me, it was a really important piece of the puzzle. And it struck me once I learned more about hormonal health, just how in my very early days of dietetics in my early 20s, how hormonal health didn't get a look in at all, and yet I was advising women who would have been in their perimenopausal or postmenopausal years, and have would never have even asked it as a question. So I can't believe that that was how I approached it. I think it is just such an integral part of how a woman feels, but also how she navigates her food choices and the sorts of food choices that she feels that her body requires often links back to hormonal health. So I think it's a really important topic. But as we'll talk about today, it's also a topic that's open to a lot of misinterpretation. And I think we as dietitians have a role to play in making sure that women are not misled around their hormonal health and the role that diet can play.
Okay, what about you, Jodie?
Yeah, so I went on a really similar journey to most of my clients, actually. I was diagnosed with PCOS in my early 20s and given no information. I was told to go on the pill, come back when I was ready to have children, and that was it. No explanation as to what PCOS was, what it meant for my health, etc. And I sought the advice of a dietitian. So I saw a dietitian who put me on a 1,200 calorie diet, despite the fact that, I was doing spin classes every day. I was training for a half marathon. I was very, very active, and I saw very little improvements to my symptoms, even following this diet that I was told I needed to follow. I did my own research and was really just baffled by all the misinformation and also the lack of information that was out there. I was studying to be a dietitian at the time, and even through my degree, I think we did one module on PCOS, and it wasn't even a whole lecture. It was like an hour. And again, it was centered around weight loss. And this just, it made no sense to me at all because I didn't need to lose weight. So how was weight loss then a solution if that wasn't something that I was struggling with? And then it all kind of spiraled from there. I didn't want to rely on the pill, but every time I went to go chat to a GP or a healthcare professional, it was a case of, well, it's either that or lose weight. And I obviously did, at the time I didn't need to lose weight. And then I hit a stage in my life where we were ready to conceive, and it took us a while to conceive with my daughter. Again, a GP told me I would never conceive naturally. I did twice, and this just fueled my passion. I also naturally attracted clients who had PCOS because I had it. And I just noticed this trend of, the serious binge restrict cycle, this battle of trying to lose weight. They either did, but they still had symptoms, or they just really struggled to lose weight. And it very clearly became evident that weight loss wasn't the solution, and there was so much more to it. And that's really what's kind of fueled my passion to make the right evidence more readily available, but also to kind of move things away from weight loss.
So it sounds like both of your experiences have really come from a place of, either experiencing something like this yourself, or from a place of recognizing there is absolutely so much misinformation, you wanting to set the record straight. So, yeah, and I think there's been a real surge in interest around hormonal health as well. So it's brilliant to be speaking about this today to get, more awareness out there and talk to experts in the field to get some of these myths kind of busted. So, to set the scene, could you give us an idea of the hormone-related conditions affecting women, Jodie?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think when we're talking about hormonal conditions, we should be focusing on diagnosable hormonal conditions. So when we're seeing really clear changes in the menstrual cycle that are present for, we generally say 3 months or more, then we can start looking at things like polycystic ovarian syndrome, endometriosis, menopause, and the different stages of menopause. So peri, post, and Laura will come on to tell us loads more about that, which I'm really looking forward to. There's thyroid conditions that are going to impact our hormones and cause hormonal related issues. So that's hypo. We've got Graves' disease, Hashimoto's. And then we come into kind of the menstrual or the conditions that are linked to the menstrual cycle. So PMDD, which is premenstrual dysphoric disorder, and premenstrual syndrome. Those are probably the more common ones that we tend to see.
Okay, and Laura, what sort of impact might these conditions have on the quality of life for those experiencing them?
Well, it has the potential to be huge. I mean, if we take premenstrual syndrome, for example, we have over 200 symptoms that link to that. Menopause as well, there's a huge spectrum of symptoms, and these can range from day-to-day disturbances to mood and anxiety levels and sleep disturbances, cognitive function. So things that really impact our day-to-day quality of life, as well as things that can increase our risk of future disease. So, for example, in menopause, we know that we have an increased risk of cardiovascular disease and osteoporosis once we've gone through the menopause. So, there is a lot at play here in terms of how it can impact a woman's health. One of the things that's so difficult, of course, is that we know that women are notoriously very difficult to study because we don't find it easy to control for the confounding factor that is a woman's menstrual cycle, because it offers that dimension or makes it very difficult to study. So the evidence is lacking, and now with the rise in awareness, particularly of things like menopause, we're starting to see more funding going into research so we can actually get some answers. But previously to this, it was a hugely underfunded area, so we just didn't have the answers that we needed.
And can I just jump in and say I think it's also because there's so much more awareness, it's a case of, these questions were just never asked before. I read something really interesting about when they were testing the COVID vaccine. They then realized when they rolled it out that women started refusing to go for the vaccine because they heard it was rumored to make changes to the menstrual cycle. And the researchers weren't able to answer why this was happening because in the studies, the participants weren't even asked about their menstrual cycle. So it's really interesting that it's never, in so much research, it's never come up as a factor. It's never been something that's been considered. Whereas we're definitely now taking a move towards where actually, no, this is a huge part of the lives of 50% of the population. And it's now starting to be considered, which I think is a huge step forward, right? I mean, it's ridiculous that it wasn't considered in studies that big. But yeah, it just goes to show how much it's been disregarded historically.
Yeah, it's definitely a step in the right direction. Broadly speaking, Jodie, what's the importance of a dietitian in supporting women with hormonal conditions?
So I think because we're seeing this trend in hormonal health and diets to balance hormones, et cetera, I think the first role that we can play is helping women identify when there is actually a diagnosable hormonal condition present. So is there actually something that needs further investigation? Because if it is a diagnosable condition, it needs to be chatted through with a GP and the relevant tests done, et cetera. So that's the first kind of step. And then as dietitians, I think it's our role to provide evidence-based information and practical strategies of how to put that information and that evidence into practice. And then ongoing personalized support to help women make informed dietary choices. And I think this is, like I said, it's more important than ever before because of the misinformation that's out there. I think it's our responsibility to try and help everyone make sense of the information that's out there and to be able to decipher between kind of what's fact, what's true, and what we don't know. And I think as dietitians, that can be quite tricky at the moment because there's such a lack of research. We can't kind of shut conversations down because we don't have the evidence to say, well, actually, no, that doesn't work because research has shown us that it doesn't work. These things haven't been tested. So it's a tricky role for us now in that we have to be open-minded and curious, but also make sure that we're steering people in the right direction and kind of shutting down the things that are potentially faddy.
Thank you for explaining. That's super clear. So back over to you then, Laura. We'll take a closer look at specific hormone-related conditions shortly, but generally, are hormonal fluctuations throughout the month usually only experienced by women or people who have a menstrual cycle?
So I think the term hormonal fluctuations is one that it's worth pausing on for a second, because we have many hormone networks within the body. They all talk to each other. So the conductors, if you like, of our hormone networks are very much the pituitary gland and the hypothalamus. And so as humans, our hormone networks really help us to function. They're tightly regulated from a physiological perspective, and there are, as I said, connections and links across all of these hormonal networks. So hormonal fluctuations across a month are absolutely normal and occur, day in, day out. Obviously, for women, there is the additional fluctuations of the reproductive cycle, and they really, as we've said, add another quite significant dimension to a woman's needs and her interpretation of those needs. So I think it's probably quite helpful to set the scene of a traditional kind of menstrual cycle and what we expect from that, because then we can really understand what we mean when it changes or when it quote unquote goes wrong. So the average cycle length is thought to be 28 days, but we know in reality that it's quite different for different women. We start off that menstrual cycle with menstruation. So that usually takes place on day one, anywhere up to day five, of the menstrual cycle. This is when our reproductive hormones, estrogen and progesterone, are low, and we're shedding, the lining of our endometrium. So this marks the start of what we call the follicular phase. And this phase for women can vary in length. But in a typical 28-day cycle, it would be around 14 days. And what we see in this phase essentially is that we are preparing to ovulate. So we get a rise in our follicle stimulating hormone, our estrogen starts to rise, and this peaks just before ovulation. Our follicle stimulating hormone starts to tail off, and we get this huge surge of luteinizing hormone, which is what triggers ovulation. So obviously, as we ovulate, we release an egg from our ovary, and we get a dip in our estrogen levels. And this then takes us into the second phase of menopause, which is the luteal phase. And this is much more fixed at a 14-day time frame. And at this point, we see estrogen and progesterone rise again, but progesterone very much takes over because progesterone's job is to protect the lining of the womb. It's there essentially to prepare that lining for possible pregnancy. And of course, if we don't fall pregnant on that particular cycle, then our estrogen and progesterone levels fall, and we have a period and we begin the cycle again.
Okay, great. That's a really clear explanation of that cycle. And obviously, many of our listeners are female, so I think it is good to recap, even though many of us are aware. It's just so interesting to hear how complex these bodily systems are and how it all works like clockwork, just through, through generations of evolution. So it's so interesting.
And I
And
think on that point, that's such an important point to note, because this is something that has been going on for thousands and thousands and thousands of years without us having to tell our body what to do. Okay. So we have to bear that in mind where we then think about the conscious brain and the food choices that we make, that this is on top of a system that knows exactly what to do, when to do it, without us having to tell it. I just want that to remain in the listeners'
yeah.
forefront of their mind as we then dispel some of the myths around balancing of hormones.
Great. Thank you, Laura. So, one trend listeners may have heard of or have been asked about by patients is adjusting dietary intake according to the stage of the menstrual cycle. Jodie, could you tell us a little bit more about this trend and what that might look like?
Sure. So this is, if we're Googling, we're going to see the title cycle syncing. And that's kind of the name it's been given. Broadly speaking, it's about eating certain types of foods and doing certain types of exercise at different stages of the menstrual cycle. And as an example, during the luteal phase, when you're likely to experience symptoms of PMS, like bloating, it would encourage foods that promoted digestion, but encourage you to avoid foods that might contribute towards bloating and gas. It encourages doing high intensity type workouts during the ovulatory phase because this is typically when your energy levels are higher. Testosterone and progesterone tend to peak, so you kind of have that euphoric top of the world feeling. So it's ultimately about adapting what you're eating and the type of exercise that you're doing according to what's going on hormonally and how you're feeling during each phase of the menstrual cycle.
And is there evidence behind a hormone balancing dietary approach being beneficial?
So I think just to kind of touch on what Laura said, this is menstrual cycles have been happening for years and years and years and years without us having to do any of this, and we've been fine. We know that diet and lifestyle do have an impact on our energy levels, on skin health. They can impact ovulation, and our bodies need a balance of nutrients and sufficient calories in order to produce hormones and function at its best. But what we don't know is whether our bodies need more of certain nutrients at certain times of the month for additional benefits. There's no evidence to validate this at the moment. So, in short, no, there is no evidence. And that's not to say that it doesn't work. We can't draw a complete line underneath it because the research simply doesn't exist. However, I think what's really important to remember is that most individuals struggle to implement the basics of healthy eating. Now we're asking them through cycle syncing to add this huge layer of complexity and saying during the luteal phase, this is what you should be eating and this is what you should be avoiding. And during the ovulatory phase, these are the different foods that you should be eating. Can you imagine having like four different diets throughout your cycle? It just, to me, it just feels completely ludicrous. So is it realistic? Absolutely not, not for your everyday individual. That's not to say that there aren't elements of it that can be incredibly helpful. I love the element of intuitive eating and intuitive movement. So responding to the increased hunger that you experience during the luteal phase, your body's telling you that it needs more energy. So responding to that is amazing. I'm all for performing high energy exercise when you wake up and your energy levels are feeling high, and practicing more gentler forms of exercise when your energy levels are low. I encourage this with my clients all the time, but going based on your menstrual cycle assumes that everyone feels the same way at certain times during their menstrual cycle, and it assumes that everyone is experiencing a regular menstrual cycle. And this is definitely not the case for individuals with PCOS and other hormonal diagnosable hormonal conditions.
So refreshing to hear you talk about it like this, because I think online, I'm a dietitian myself, you even as as a consumer, I can get sucked into a lot of these kind of marketing campaigns. I actually do work in marketing, so it's amazing how they do hook you in, using emotive messages and testimonials. So it's incredibly refreshing to hear you kind of set the story straight and say the evidence actually isn't there. And I think a lot of people want the shiniest, newest recommendation that's going to make them excited. And a lot of the time, the kind of staple healthy eating principles aren't the ones that get people the most excited. And unfortunately, people don't necessarily want to listen to those, when actually it does, essentially just go back to basics sometimes. And it's about those healthy eating principles and getting those right first.
Yeah, absolutely. It's that shiny object syndrome, right? The basic guidelines, they're really boring, they're not sexy. So as soon as someone puts a different spin on this, it's suddenly, oh, okay, this sounds really interesting. This is something that people can kind of hold on to and feel like it's going to make a huge difference.
And does this link to the concept of seed cycling? This term was something I had never heard of before, so I actually had to Google it before this episode, admittedly. But could you explain this concept for those unfamiliar, and is there any evidence for this practice?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is actually something I was quite familiar with because I hear and see it so much in the world of PCOS. So seed cycling, it's a naturopathic approach, and it involves eating specific seeds again at certain times during the menstrual cycle to try and help balance hormones, specifically estrogen and progesterone. There's no research available on the practice of seed cycling, like none whatsoever. We know that there are multiple benefits to consuming seeds and that different types of seeds are going to have a different nutritional profile. We know that they're high in fiber. So, seeds absolutely make a positive contribution to the diet. There's a little bit of research behind some of the nutrients found in seeds and their specific role in the menstrual cycle. So, an example is there's a study that confirms that consuming zinc before menstruation may help reduce menstrual pain. However, again, going back to how realistic this practice is, focusing on consuming certain seeds at specific times adds an unnecessary layer of complexity to something that is already very complex. Simply adding more seeds and having a variety of seeds to your diet is going to be beneficial because of the nutritional profile of the different seeds. So no, there's no evidence. It's not something that I would recommend to anyone, not even with PCOS. Add healthy fats to your diet. And again, that comes back to basic guidelines. That's what we're encouraging or should be encouraging people to do anyways. But seed cycling it's a no from me.
Okay, thank you. And are these practices still applicable if women are taking hormone treatments such as the pill or have gone through menopause?
So again, I think, if we're looking at things like, or if we're talking about adding a variety of seeds to the diet, eating and moving more intuitively, which is ultimately what these things are about, then yes, I think these are great practices that anyone would benefit from. As women go through menopause, their menstrual cycle might become more less predictable. So seed cycling and eating based on the menstrual cycle is going to be more challenging to follow. But it's not necessary anyways. So I think yes, look at adding healthy fats to your diet, look at eating and moving more intuitively, but these practices of seed cycling and cycle syncing, it's not going to be beneficial to anyone. I think it's just going to confuse people even more. It, like I say, adds a layer of complexity. And yeah, we'll touch on it a little bit later, but to me, these are just diets in sheep's clothing and they really just scream disordered eating. And yeah, I wouldn't encourage them.
Okay, I'm sure many of us will appreciate that clarity, so thank you. Looking more closely at some specific hormone-related conditions dietitians may be faced with, let's start with perimenopause or menopause. Laura, what's going on hormonally at this time?
So perimenopause is essentially a huge period of flux in estrogen primarily, but also progesterone as well. And perimenopause can last a matter of months, or for some women, it can last a number of years. So we know that the average age of a woman to go through menopause in the UK is 51. So we would expect anywhere from the age of 45 upwards that a woman is likely to be in her perimenopausal years. And they're really characterized by these huge fluctuations, as I said, in estrogen and progesterone. And it's the instability in these fluctuations that causes such havoc for the body. So remember, the body likes homeostasis, it likes things to have this natural ebb and flow and for everything to be regulated. And so what we see in perimenopause is that the body's supply of estrogen is starting to decrease. So we get surges of follicle stimulating hormone as the body is essentially trying to squeeze as much estrogen out of the ovaries as it can. And some days your estrogen levels therefore might be quite high, and other days they might be quite low. It's quite challenging because there isn't really a blood test that you can do to diagnose perimenopause. In some cases, women might have their follicle stimulating hormone levels checked, and if they were under the age of 40, where we wouldn't expect a woman to be going through menopause, if she was experiencing symptoms that were affecting her menstrual cycle, her FSH levels might well be checked because they would help to form a clinical picture. Between the age of 40 and 45, it's a bit of a grey area whether it's worth doing any blood tests or not. And certainly over the age of 45, you really should be looking at the clinical symptom picture in front of you. So blood tests are not going to add anything to that, because it might be that the day that you have your bloods checked, your FSH level happens to be high, and the next day it might be low. So it's not a good indicator, and it's far more important that we look at and help women to join the dots with the different symptoms that they are experiencing. Because until recently, where menopause was talked about far more freely, women might not have been putting two and two together and might have thought that actually they were in the in fact, there's many case studies that tell us that some women feel that they're in the early stages of dementia, for example, because their brain fog is so severe. A lot of women historically have been prescribed antidepressants to cope with the mood changes, when actually giving these women hormone replacement therapy sorts out their mood regulation almost overnight. So these perimenopausal years are different for every woman. Some women might not experience any perimenopausal symptoms, and others they would really have, a pretty terrible time of it. Whether we replace those hormones is an individual decision. It is generally considered that the types of hormone replacement that we use these days, which is a combination of transdermal estrogen, so in a gel, a patch, or a spray, the estrogen is absorbed through the skin. It's incredibly safe. And if a woman still has her uterus, then she will need a form of progesterone as well. She might have that in tablet form, or she might have that in the form of a Mirena coil. So that type of HRT, where you're using a combination of estrogen and progesterone, is by far the most common used in the UK. It's generally really well tolerated, helps with symptom management, and also has the added benefit of helping to protect our health. So we mentioned earlier things like cardiovascular disease, osteoporosis, and potentially helping to protect our cognitive function as well. However, it's only licensed for use in symptom management, not in protection of health. So in replacing estrogen, we can do that through hormone replacement therapy. We can't do that in any other way. So we have botanical supplements, for example, and some food components, such as phytoestrogens, which can mimic the effects of estrogen in the body by binding to estrogen receptors. And we can talk more about that in a moment, but they are not replacing the body's estrogen supply. They are merely mimicking the effects of it, and therefore can help with some of the symptoms of perimenopause. And just for clarity, menopause really, by definition, is only one day in a woman's life, because it is defined as 12 months since a woman has had a period. So it's really only one day in a woman's life. And then she enters into those postmenopausal years, which, due to our increased life expectancy, we could be spending a third of our lives postmenopausally. So nutrition really is quite a cornerstone part of our health armor, if you like, in our postmenopausal years. But as we've said, the perimenopausal phase is the bit where everything, is a little bit more erratic, and nutrition really does play an important part in anchoring us. But I just wanted to circle back to one of the things that Jodie said, and I thought she was absolutely spot on. I think we are living in a society now where we're bombarded by health information, and we are being fed this line, excuse the pun, that we don't know enough, that we've got all of this emerging research, and that this is going to path the way for us to do it better. And actually, what I think it's doing is we're feeling that we don't have motivation to eat a healthy, balanced diet, when actually, I think we just don't have clarity. And we're getting distracted from the absolute day in, day out basics of those nutritional anchor points, because we're being led to believe that this stuff is far more complicated than it actually is. So we've got to come back to, absolutely, nutrition can play a part in supporting our hormonal health. but not in the way in which it's being bandied around with people who have loud voices.
Well said. And you mentioned there about the fact that there is evidence base for HRT and it's well tolerated. But what about the evidence base behind eating for hormonal health then in perimenopause and menopause? I know you spoke about it just briefly there, but could you elaborate on the science behind those principles?
Yeah, so it's really interesting, and as Jodie said, we want to have lots of research because it is fascinating, and the three of us are sat here because we have a passion for nutritional science. But unfortunately, there are huge gaps, and we need to be careful that we don't make leaps. So, for example, we can see that estrogen does play a role in how we utilize carbohydrate and fat within the body. So there are changes across a menstrual cycle in terms of how we're using those fuels. But that can't yet translate into, right, therefore, this is exactly the makeup of macronutrients that you need to be eating. As we've said, in perimenopause, it's characterized by these fluctuations in hormones. So we can't therefore say that there is one approach macronutrient content of the diet that's going to suit a perimenopausal woman, because it's going to differ day to day. We can see postmenopausally, so when we compare premenopausal women to postmenopausal, that we have we're in a more pro-inflammatory state. So one of the key things to know about estrogen is that it is an anti-inflammatory. So once we lose estrogen, we are in generally a more sort of systemic pro-inflammatory state. So the role that diet can play then in supporting us with anti-inflammatory foods, and that's very much the Mediterranean approach, is really important. But we can't, again, get too hung up on specific foods having particular effects on hormones per se, because that's just not what happens. Yeah, so if we look at perimenopause generally, we can see that it's an opportunity to develop more of this interoceptive awareness that we've kind of hinted towards. So we live in a society again which promotes us really to not listen to our body signals, because we're living in a world where we're working at far faster pace. And if we think what we've said ancestrally about our menstrual cycle and how well it served us over these generations, we've also in previous generations had the opportunity to rest when we've needed to rest and listen when we've needed to listen, and everything has just been happening at a slower pace. Well, fast forward now to a world where we're really switching off from our basic bodily functions in order to hit the productivity targets that society dictates are a measure of our self-worth, right? So actually, what these perimenopausal years are an opportunity to do is to take that pause, that literal pause, and to start to tune back in to what our body is telling us. So Jodie mentioned in the luteal phase in particular, we have food cravings. Well, we know in perimenopause that we tend to have greater cravings. As I said, when we look at premenopause and postmenopause blood glucose levels, we can see postmenopausal women have more erratic blood glucose levels. They tend to have bigger dips and troughs in their blood glucose levels, all of which can contribute then to cravings for carbohydrate. We know that estrogen is involved in the production of serotonin. So when we lose estrogen, we then have a desire for usually processed carbohydrates foods, because they are obviously giving us that dopamine hit that helps to counteract the lack of serotonin that we've got. So on the one hand, we've got habits which we know we fall into. Perimenopausal women have a lot of coping strategies that they have to rely on, because they are likely to have mood fluctuations. They might have more anxiety. They are more likely to have sleep disturbances. Hot flushes, night sweats, of course, are one of the most common menopausal symptoms. So it's quite common that coping strategies will look like a higher processed food intake, higher sugar intake, maybe more alcohol, maybe more caffeine, because we might be more tired and fatigued generally with the load that life is presenting to us at this phase of life. We might not want to go into the kitchen and cook a wholesome dinner based on minimally processed foods, etc., etc. So that's on the one hand. And yes, then on the other hand, we know that a diet which is following that Mediterranean pattern, which is rich in antioxidants, which is containing healthy fats, monounsaturated and polyunsaturated, the role of fiber in its capacity to influence our gut health. There's so much that we can do from a dietary perspective. And so therefore, as a dietitian, I see my role is in helping women to navigate this stuff, to actually make consistent, sustainable changes to their diet, in service of a Mediterranean type diet. But actually, a lot of the work is done in really looking at the practicalities and the mindset work around making that happen, because the reality is that we don't eat particularly well when we are using food as a coping strategy. And we can see really clearly why food does become a coping strategy because of these hormonal fluctuations and the knock-on effect that they have on how we feel.
And there's just so many layers to the one individual, and it's just really about being that people-centered, having a people-centered approach when you're dealing with patients and clients. And I suppose it's your role as a dietitian, as a practitioner, to break that down and simplify it and not overwhelm the person sat in front of you. I can really see how there's so many factors that come into this. And yeah, both of you, I can see, are probably fantastic at explaining it all, making that person feel really at sort of at ease, which is part of it, part of the dietary therapy. So yeah, thank you for explaining all of that.
Yeah, you speak to the point of being at ease, but part of that is also around self-compassion, because actually, once we are able to shed self-compassion on the complexity of this mix, we are then able to remain quite solution focused. The problem is that we live in a wellness culture which encourages us to be quite critical. We get quite judgy. Like Jodie said, it is bonkers to think, on top of the already very long to-do list, that we suddenly have a certain list of foods that we can eat at certain times of the month. It really doesn't make any sense unless you want food and the navigation of your food choices to be your full-time job. Which, for many women who are the backbone of this entire country, that's not going to be very practical. So, can you balance your hormones with food? No. Can you harness your hormones through food? Yes. And that's the role that dietitians can really support people to do.
Great, great. Both Jodie and I are nodding our heads, listening to you there, Laura. So true.
Absolutely.
Moving on to PCOS, Jodie, this seems to be a more established area in terms of research and guidance. Is that right?
Yes and no. There is a good amount of research around PCOS. However, there's also still a huge amount of gaps and a lot more that needs to be done. A lot of the research is focused on weight loss, which we know isn't the solution to PCOS. And the research that's out there is all very short term. So, like any research that's been done in women's health, it's very underfunded and there's still big gaps. So yes, we do have more, but there's absolutely still a huge need for even further research.
Okay, so maybe a good place to start would be telling us about the different types of PCOS. Could you do that for our listeners, please?
Yeah, of course. So in theory, there's four different phenotypes of PCOS, and these are referred to as A, B, C, and D. And the reason these phenotypes were introduced was because there was a lot of confusion around the diagnostic criteria for PCOS. The diagnostic criteria has changed a couple of times over the years. And at one point, the hyperandrogenism, so the excess of androgens, had to be prevalent to receive a diagnosis. And what happened here was that because women were presenting with other aspects of PCOS, but their androgen levels were normal, they couldn't then be diagnosed with PCOS. And
healthcare professionals were kind of a bit stumped of, what do we do with these women who clearly look like they have PCOS, but we can't diagnose it because their androgen levels are normal. And this is when the phenotypes were introduced. So just quickly to remind everyone, we use what we call the Rotterdam criteria to diagnose PCOS. And this essentially means that individuals must present with two of the three criteria. So that's hyperandrogenism, menstrual irregularities, and the presence of polycystic ovaries, or we can now use AMH levels as a diagnostic criteria instead of the presence of cysts on the ovary, so not having to do those invasive intravaginal scans. So the phenotypes were introduced in 2012 by the National Institute of Health to try and provide more clarity around PCOS and be able to diagnose women more effectively. So we've got, is it helpful for me to run through the different phenotypes? Or
Sure.
yeah. So we've got phenotype A, which is the presence of hyperandrogenism, ovulatory dysfunction, and the presence of polycystic ovaries. You've got phenotype B, and phenotype A, sorry, is the most kind of symptomatic. That's what we call full-blown PCOS. We've then got phenotype B, which is hyperandrogenism and ovulatory dysfunction, but there's no polycystic ovaries. So the ovaries present as normal. And then you've got phenotype C, which is hyperandrogenism and polycystic ovaries, but no ovulatory dysfunction. And then there's phenotype D, which tends to be kind of the less symptomatic of the four. And this is the presence of polycystic ovaries and ovulatory dysfunction, but no hyperandrogenism. So no symptoms of that kind of elevated testosterone levels. That's kind of the phenotypes in a nutshell.
Okay. So how does the role of diet then come into play? And how does dietary advice need to be tailored to the symptoms and specific types of these phenotypes of PCOS?
Yeah, so it's a good question. I think the phenotypes were introduced to help from a diagnostic perspective. In terms of a treatment perspective, they're not massively helpful. I don't use them to treat my patients because ultimately the client that's sitting in front of you and how they're presenting with their PCOS is going to determine how you treat them. So yes, we've got these four different phenotypes, but what we need to remember about PCOS is that it's a syndrome. So everyone is going to present quite differently, and that's what you're treating at the end of the day. I think there's some really exciting research actually that I had a sneak insight into. It's part of the DAISY study on PCOS, and they're looking at these three distinct steroid metabolome clusters in PCOS and the metabolic risks associated with each of these three clusters. And it's actually showing that women in one of these clusters is more prone to insulin resistance and the symptoms associated with this. So now they're taking it one step further to say, okay, this is how it presents. Now this is potentially how we could treat it. And they're just starting or about to start some trials in terms of treating these three clusters differently, which is really exciting because at the moment, like I say, yes, we've got these phenotypes and they help us kind of classify the type of PCOS, but at the end of the day, it means nothing for how you treat that person that sat in front of you.
And are there any commonalities or common trends in terms of dietary management of PCOS? Do you see something quite frequently in patients that you tend to recommend from a dietary perspective?
Yeah, so I think the three kind of things that sit behind the more symptomatic PCOS clients are inflammation and insulin resistance. Those are the kind of mechanisms that sit behind a lot of the symptoms with PCOS. So ultimately, it's about an anti-inflammatory diet. So looking at incorporating the Mediterranean diet, but also then supporting them in increasing their insulin resistance, or sorry, not insulin resistance, their insulin sensitivity and how their bodies are responding to insulin. So, things like making sure they're eating enough protein. We're not talking high protein diets, just enough protein, looking at the quality of their carbohydrates, incorporating exercise so that their bodies are more efficient at how it kind of handles glucose. But ultimately, it's also about, all the things that Laura touched on. It's looking at stress because we know that cortisol is a big contributor towards PCOS symptoms, and it kind of aggravates those hormonal mechanisms, it's about sleep, because that's also going to impact kind of how you feel within yourself. It's going to impact your appetite to make healthy changes, your energy levels, and being able to exercise. So yes, it's about diet and those specific kind of elements around insulin resistance and inflammation, but it's looking at that bigger picture at the end of the day as well.
Okay. And supplements have grown in popularity recently. Could you tell us whether there are any supplements which have evidence to support them in the management of PCOS and how they work?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the spotlight is really on inositol. It's probably got the most promising research behind it and its role in managing PCOS. And it works both as an insulin sensitizer, but also plays a role in improving ovulation and egg quality. So from a fertility perspective, it can also be a really helpful supplement. Some studies have shown that it's equally as effective as metformin, but it doesn't have the side effects. And I think that's really exciting because loads of GPs are prescribing metformin and patients are really struggling with the side effects of that. So if we can offer something that has the same impact without the side effects, then that's really, really exciting. The research behind vitamin D, it's promising, although it's not yet understood kind of exactly why. Studies are showing that supplementation with vitamin D has helped reduce CRP levels, so helping reduce that inflammation, reduces cholesterol, parathyroid hormone, and total testosterone levels. So that's exciting to see that research. And we also know that there's a higher prevalence of vitamin D deficiency in those with PCOS, and there's links between adequate vitamin D levels and fertility. So it's a really important supplement to look at and to discuss with your PCOS patients. Obviously, everyone should be supplementing with vitamin D through the autumn and winter months anyways, and for some people all year round. But it's definitely something to be aware of in the world of PCOS. And then because of this kind of chronic low-grade inflammation that we see in PCOS, omega-3 can also be helpful in reducing that inflammation. But then again, encouraging those good sources of omega-3 in the diet is also beneficial. PCOS is a tricky one. There's lots of research looking at things like berberine, chromium, L-carnitine, coenzyme Q10. And I often get patients that are taking a list of supplements as long as their arm. But there's just not enough evidence, not enough strong evidence to warrant recommendations of all of these supplements. It's always diet first for me. People look at, again, it's that shiny object syndrome. It's what's going to be the quickest and the easiest solution for me, which is why people are so attracted to supplements. But at the end of the day, there's no amount of supplement that is going to make up for dietary deficits or lack of physical activity. So we should always be discussing those things first. And supplements are, you know, just a little helper along the way.
Definitely. Always good to take that food first approach. I agree. Before we look at more general hormonal health trends, let's touch on premenstrual syndrome, otherwise known as PMS. Laura, could you define PMS for us and what's going on hormonally?
Yeah, so PMS is, as you say, premenstrual syndrome. And we know that in a certain subset of women that they are just more prone to feeling the effects of these hormonal fluctuations and shifts in neurotransmitters that the body experiences. So there's a very high percentage of women who will notice that they have some form of symptom around their period. So as Jodie touched on earlier, things like bloating and abdominal cramps are, of course, very common. But PMS refers specifically to the severity of those symptoms. So it's generally thought to affect about 20% of premenopausal women. And it refers to either the number or the severity of the symptoms that woman might experience associated with her menstrual cycle. So again, it's a really interesting area because we would like to think that diet can play a role in managing those symptoms. And yes, it can, but We are, as Jodie said, I think desperate to think that there are particular supplements that we could take that have strong evidence that they make a difference. The research seems to, as always, be quite mixed. Certain nutrients, though, seem to be coming round time and time again. So I think Jodie mentioned zinc earlier, calcium, magnesium, vitamin D, and B vitamins are certainly the top of the list in terms of those micronutrients that seem to be having more of an impact on our ability to manage PMS. But we are, again, not at the stage where we can routinely be recommending that certain supplements be taken because there seems to be discrepancy in the research. But certainly, looking at those micronutrients in particular, considering dietary sources of those, and working with women to see whether they are likely to be meeting their nutritional requirements for those micronutrients is a really important first step. And vitamin D in particular, as Jodie said, we know that there are dietary sources of it, but that we are predominantly making it from the sunlight. And if we are taking that 10 micrograms through the autumn and winter, that might not be enough. And it can be advisable for women who have PMS. And the same goes for perimenopause, actually, that it might be worth getting your vitamin D checked, because if it is low or too low, then that 10 micrograms sort of public health recommendation is just not going to be enough to get it up to what it needs to be. So, and I can speak from personal experience when I say that. So I think it is important that we get the right dosage of vitamin D, and getting levels checked can be really helpful with that. But similarly, as we've said with other hormonal conditions, in PMS, it can be quite common that people look to use food to cope with those symptoms. So we tend to see higher intakes of sugar, caffeine, alcohol. And so step number one is supporting women to understand the reasons why they're experiencing these symptoms, and to start to look at it in a more sort of broader way to find ways in which they can navigate healthier choices, coming away from these things that we tend to use as a crux to get us through, those difficult days of the month. So diet is definitely a key modifiable factor in reducing and managing our symptoms of PMS. But unfortunately, specific foods or specific nutrients, the research is just a little bit sparse and sporadic, and really doesn't have the scientific rigor behind it that we need to be able to say, yes, absolutely, take this, do that.
Okay, understood. It seems eating for hormonal health is huge across the internet and on social media. A Google search, for example, brings up results such as a hormone balancing diet, increasing cruciferous vegetable intake, avoidance of sugar, amongst many others. Can you tell us more about these trends and where they might have come from, Jodie?
Yeah, so there's so much to say about this, and I think I could speak about it for hours, but I'll try and summarize kind of a couple of the key factors and things that are coming into play here. So there's a definite trend around glucose levels and the impact of fluctuating glucose levels on hormone health. This is getting so much airtime at the moment, and it's one of the big drivers behind this hormone health trend. There's a lot of kind of fear mongering happening around glucose spikes, et cetera, when actually they're just a very normal part of our day. And it's not something that we need to fear or that we need to respond or amend our diet to. So that kind of glucose trend is one driving factor. There's also a broader shift towards taking holistic approaches to wellness and a recognition of the kind of interconnectedness of diet and lifestyle on hormonal health, which is great to see that people are becoming more aware of the impact of their diet and lifestyle on hormonal health. I think there's sadly a lot of mistrust in Western medicine, and a lot of this is driven by the fact that, we now know that there's a huge lack of research in women's health, but also there's women wanting to do things more naturally, and not wanting to use medications and hormonal treatments, which I guess is a good and a bad thing. There's a time and a place for everything. But that's again something that sits behind the trend that we're seeing. There's a shift, there's been a huge shift in how we talk about women's health. It's less taboo to talk about things like the menstrual cycle and menopause, which is fantastic. It means that these topics are gaining so much more exposure, but with that comes, the not necessarily the right voices shouting about different elements and aspects and how to deal with it. I also believe, and Laura touched on this earlier, that there's a lot of pressure on women in society to be able to do it all. We have careers, we're mothers, we're wives, we're friends. There's so much pressure on women to play such a big role in society now, and this brings stress and burnout. And a lot of people are jumping on this and seeing this as an opportunity. To kind of make women believe that they need to fix their diet, they need to balance their glucose levels, when actually they probably need to work on stress, finding balance, and society needs to figure out kind of how to support women better, to remove some of these pressures, and that is, sitting behind a lot of the symptoms that we're experiencing. And then I think there's also a huge amount of this is driven by the diet industry. It's not cool to talk about weight loss anymore. It's very taboo to be seen to promote weight loss, which is amazing, but it just means they're now finding a different way to talk about it. So effectively, for a lot of the messaging that we're hearing at the moment, it's essentially just a diet in sheep's clothing. So I think these are some of the elements that are coming into play. But like I say, this is a huge topic all on its own that I could talk about for hours.
Can I just jump in on that? Because I think it's useful to make some parallels in the conversation. So we were talking earlier about the differences in blood glucose levels in premenopausal women as compared to post. And so we can certainly see as a result of menopause that we have less sensitivity to insulin. So we don't seem to be tolerating glucose as well in that evening meal as we did when we were premenopausal. And this can then lead to this notion that we need to be on low carbohydrate diets. Intermittent fasting is another trend which is hugely popular within the menopausal space. And yet, what I see from a clinical perspective is that we're so fearful of carbohydrates. We've got some sense that perhaps we're not processing them, quote unquote, as well as we did premenopausally. So our instinct then is to really reduce our carbohydrate intake. But actually, what I see is that women just don't eat properly during the day. Then they've got this idea that they should be really limiting their food intake in the evening to create this fast. And they're sort of sitting on their hands and trying their best to avoid the kitchen cupboards. And often what we see is this sort of binge-like behavior in the evenings because finally they get to sit down on the sofa having, worked their socks off all day and tended to everyone else's needs. And finally at 9 o'clock at night, they just want that little bit of downtime before they crawl into bed. And then they're trying to build up their willpower reserves to resist the biscuits and the crisps and the wine and the chocolate and whatever. So again, we've got this scenario where you've got the research that, yes, suggests that perhaps we do need to be looking at how much carbohydrate we eat in the evening as compared to earlier on in the day, breakfast, lunch, snacking, etc. But blended with actually the realities of how we actually eat and navigate food choices in day-to-day life. So in the case of menopause, we can use that research to our advantage, but we've actually got to use it in a way that's quite empowering so that women see the benefit of fueling themselves better earlier in the morning, actually allowing themselves to have lunch. That you'd be surprised the number of women who skip lunch because they just don't have time. They don't see it as important. They have to think so much energy goes into what they're going to feed the family in the evening that the idea that they've also got to think about what they give themselves for lunch is just a step too far. You know, these are the practical realities of the women that I work with. None of which gets airtime from the people, as Jodie said, who are banging the drum about the importance of eat this, don't eat that. It's just creating either FOMO or paranoia around this stuff, and it's preventing people from making change that's actually going to be helpful.
And
I think Laura, a really important thing to acknowledge there is this lack of research is so dangerous because as healthcare professionals, we cannot say anything when we don't have research to validate what we're saying, right? Whereas for everyone else who doesn't have a title that is protected, where they're under scrutiny constantly, they can shout as loud as they want. And going back to that COVID research, there was so much talk around how the COVID vaccine was impacting fertility and it was so bad for female health. And people that didn't have a protected title were really shouting about this, which is why it gained so much momentum and so much traction. Yet for the healthcare professionals, we couldn't even stand up for the vaccine or stand up for ourselves because there was no research to support us. And I think that's what's really sticky about this area is for those without protected titles, they're shouting, "Oh, well, this works for me, therefore it's going to work for you." And we're sat there going, "Well, we can't really say a huge amount because we don't have the evidence." So it puts us in a really difficult position.
I'm sure many of us listening, will be, resonating with what you're saying completely, because it is a really difficult space. And there has, glucose is a huge buzzword at the moment. There's lots of talk around different products and monitoring of glucose, and how sustainable is that? We don't know how useful is that. Again, we're not too sure. So it does put us in a really difficult position as healthcare professionals, which is why having these conversations and communicating evidence-based nutrition on platforms such as this is hopefully really helpful, and will help dietitians and other healthcare professionals navigate these often difficult conversations. Another trend that we have seen is the Dutch, and again, this is something that I or Dutch test, sorry. And again, wasn't too familiar with this. Jodie, are you able to tell us a little bit about this test and what it stands for and what you think about it?
Yeah, sure. So the Dutch test is dried urine for comprehensive hormones. So it's hormone testing or testing hormonal levels using urine samples, essentially. And there's no research to kind of back it up. It's incredibly expensive as well. So I guess, I like the idea of it that people just need to do a urine sample or we can test their hormone levels. And, it saves if you have a fear of needles, it saves having to go in for a daunting blood test. But there's simply no research to kind of validate it. And I think it comes down to at the end of the day, if you are genuinely concerned about having a hormonal balance and you're noticing irregularities in your menstrual cycle, go to your GP, have a conversation with your GP, and they will request, they'll assess whether there's a need for blood tests and then request the necessary blood test, as opposed to you having to spend hundreds of pounds on something that is potentially inaccurate.
Okay. Laura, over to you. Where would you like to see the research focus in this area?
Well, just more of it and more high quality. I mean, we all know that the pinnacle, of course, is the randomized control trial, but even just more observational data where we can really start to even have confidence around certain associations between dietary components and symptom management, for example. But as we've spoken a lot about today, the evidence that we do have is the equivalent to, Sue down the road said that this worked. And that's fine. We can do that with the caveat of do try these things, see if they make a difference to you, review it in 3 months. There are we want to be helpful. We're in a profession where we want to help, right? So we can look at the data that we've got and make the best of it, but fundamentally, it just isn't strong enough in so many of these areas. And hopefully, with the spotlight on hormonal health, that will help to generate more funding so that more research can actually be done that is more meaningful and, stops the cowboys getting carried away and selling us stuff that we don't need. And we as dietitians can actually start to have, a better toolkit from which we can pull from with confidence.
Okay, so over time, hopefully things will become a little bit clearer, or we can definitely hope for that in terms of a brighter future when it comes to our hormonal health. But I think sticking to basics and sticking to some of the things that both of you have discussed around, anti-inflammatory diets, the Mediterranean diet, exercise, that's definitely the path that we should be recommending our clients and patients to go forward on. And finally, Jodie, can you share some key tips and considerations for supporting women with hormonal health? We'll go to you first, Jodie, and then we'll finish with Laura, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think firstly, if your patients believe there's something going on, like I said, and they've been experiencing big changes in the menstrual cycle, they should be having a conversation with their GP, and we should really be actively encouraging that as well to rule out any medical conditions or concerns. I think it's so important, again, we've touched on this, to look at the bigger picture. This is so much more than just a diet and exercise issue. It's sleep, stress, schedule, societal pressures, mental health. And we can't do our job as dietitians without looking at all of these, because these, it ultimately affects our food choices and the ability to make change. And I think that, in this space where we have such limited research, dietitians are known or renowned for kind of going, no, that's not something you should be doing. And actually, to Laura's point, if someone has seen something like, I don't know, let's use seed cycling as an example, and they believe that it's going to make a huge difference, or they've tried it and they believe it's had a hugely positive impact, our job as dietitians is to kind of lay out any risks that we're aware of, the benefits, but then also kind of just advise consumers and clients and patients how to implement this on a practical level. So instead of kind of being these gatekeepers, just kind of giving them the tools to find practical ways to put these things into practice, but also highlighting the risks of adding further complexity, just being helping be really realistic, I guess.
Great advice. And how about you, Laura?
Yeah, just following on from that, I think we really need to be supporting women to recognize that we have our psychological health and our physical health, and those two things are inextricably combined, And if we are following dietary practices because we believe it to be the right thing for us, but actually it's affecting our emotional health and it's making it very difficult for us to, interact authentically and have mindful moments in the day and joy to our life and quality of life and all of these sorts of things, then we really need to take a step back. So overall, I would say we've got to be able to flex that compassion muscle. We've got to be able to understand or be open to understanding that there are physiological reasons why we have certain food habits, or what you might notice that we have certain food preferences at different times of the month. And we've got to lean into that. We've got to listen to that. We've got to understand that these are not failings in our moral code of achieving the perfect diet, but that we actually need to understand that we're quite complex and quite nuanced. And if we inform ourselves a little bit more of the physiology of what's happening in our bodies, it enables us then to navigate food decisions that are going to be more healthful and helpful to us, from a place of compassion rather than judgment, which I think is hugely helpful. It keeps us in human mode. It enables us to join some dots. It enables us to really advocate for our health in a completely different way. So that would be the message that I would like to feel gets out there more.
A brilliant way to close the debate. Thank you. So thank you so much, Laura and Jodie, for coming onto the podcast today.
You're welcome. Lovely to
Thanks
be here.
for having me. Yeah, it's been great. Thanks for having me.
It was so good to chat to you both and learn more about this area, as well as unpack some myths. A huge thank you to Nualtra for making this podcast possible. And if you enjoyed listening to today's episode, why not share it with a friend or colleague who you think would find it interesting? Our next episode of the Dietitian Cafe will be out soon. But in the meantime, you can check out our previous episodes or head over to our RD2B Dietitian Cafe podcast, where once a month, our student dietitian host discusses the world of dietetics with a range of guests, all aimed at aspiring dietitians. Thank you for joining us at the Dietitian Cafe. See you next time.